Parshas Noach, of course. Parshas Noach is a packed parsha in so many ways. Shvi stands on its own. Shvi stands on its own as a very packed aliyah. Happens to be very long. It is the entire 11th parak of Sefer Bereishis, and contained within that whole parak, within those 31, 32 psukim, is quite a bit of the entire story of Migdal Bavel, which seems to go by very quickly, is only the first few psukim, and then towards the end, essentially the origin story of Avram Avinu, the beginning, the introduction of Avram Avinu onto the historical stage. Of course, next week in Parshas Lech Lecha, we'll really step into the limelight. But our Parsha makes sure, just like last week's Parsha, makes sure to get Noach onto the table before Noach actually starts. So too, this week's Parsha gets Avram onto the table before Avram's story actually begins with next week's Parsha. So that's the end of the Aliyah. And the first Aliyah is, again, the story of Migdal Bavel. And in between is many, many names, which we won't necessarily read together, but is the whole generational list between Noach and Avram. And the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos tells us that there is a message here that HaKadosh Baruch Hu's patience. We have HaKadosh Baruch Hu's patience between Adam and Noach, the 10 generations. And then again, all the generations between Noach and Avram, that they all angered God, but God waited out. God tolerated the situation until Avram Avinu shows up. And Avram ends up being notol schar kulam, taking the schar of all of them, which is an interesting concept. And maybe we'll say a few words about that. So let's take a look from the beginning. And we'll have to consider the fact that there are many different interpretations, some of them perhaps slightly contradictory of each other, but many different interpretations of what exactly is the background and what are the facts and what is the message of Migdal Bavel. And that's also a good complement to the beginning of the parasha, which suggests that, which tells us the story of the Dor HaMabul, which was guilty of something, and what exactly something. Chazal have many different perspectives. So too, when it comes to the end of the parasha, we have a similar story, a generation that is guilty of something, and what exactly is requires a close reading. In fact, the Medrash suggests that the Dor HaMabul, their sin is more explicit, even though Chazal still have differing views on what exactly it was. While when it comes to the generation of the Tower, which is about 340 years later, is a significant time period later, their Avera is less explicit, and we need, as Rosham Shnafal Hirsch has a comment, we need to read very carefully to see what exactly is going on, what exactly is the story trying to tell us. And it's interesting also to note that some of the Mefarshim point out that you see here kind of a pendulum in terms of history and in terms of the values of society and their extremes. That when it comes to the question of capitalism and communism, and what exactly are the values of each system, what are the pros and what are the cons, so neither is a system that is identical with the Torah completely. This is something that we talk about a little bit in our business ethics class. I've taken that class, talk about it there a little bit, that there has been a historical debate for many centuries about the values of capitalism and communism, and neither is perfect. For the most part, we tend to identify more with capitalism, and that's something that has a lot to clarify and to explore. It's not a 100% perfect identification. And each one needs to be modified if it's going to be something that we're comfortable with religiously and morally. So there are those who suggest, I believe if you look in tradition, Rabbi Yitzchak Blau wrote an article about this many years ago, I believe he quotes some of these perspectives, that within our parsha we find the pendulum swinging from one end to the other in terms of these issues. That the Dor HaMabul, the story of Noach and the flood, there you have essentially a capitalist nightmare. Basically, they come from a materialist focus that they want to get money, they want to exploit each other. That concept of exploitation, the idea of chamas, you know, the idea of kind of maneuvering the law to get as much as you can out of the other. So that's exactly what people criticize about capitalism, and perhaps that's what we're reading about. We're reading about a society that is capitalist in that sense, is materialist, and in a way that is disproportionate and imbalanced and immoral, and ultimately gets destroyed. While when you get to the door of the tower at the end here in Aralia, so the pendulum has swung to the other direction, and you have essentially a communist society with a lot of what is familiar from some of the debates about communism. You have a society where everyone is getting together with a common goal, and where, as we'll see, and this is especially emphasized in some of the Midrashim, that their humanity is sublimated towards this common goal, the idea of challenging God. Atheism was often a part of communist cultures as well. So a lot of it seems to suggest that, or a lot of it will seem familiar from critiques of communism. So it seems like our parsha is kind of swinging from the pendulum from one end to the other, a capitalist situation gone awry in the beginning of the parsha, and a communist situation gone awry in the end of the parsha. And by the time we get to next week's parsha, so the pendulum will be swinging back again towards capitalism, also in a very criticized form. And it's important to understand, because the Torah, if you had to pick one or the other, the Torah does seem to be at its core a capitalist system. We believe in private property, we believe in ownership, we believe in the prohibitions and the commandments that surround these concepts, but not in a unmitigated way, that if one were to be capitalist without any kinds of correctives to make sure that the poor are taken care of, so then you have a very cruel, heartless society. And that's what seems to be described in next week's parsha, when you hear about Sodom. And Sodom, again, is a society which is so evil that they have to be destroyed. The Torah just tells us that they're evil and that they get destroyed. That's all we know about them from the Torah itself. But Chazal, in a halachic context, really in a very significant, rigid way, Chazal tell us that the nature of the people of Sodom, it's a kind of unmitigated capitalism. Basically, as the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos puts it, Shali, Shali, Shalcha, Shalcha, what's mine is mine, and what's yours is yours, which doesn't sound so terrible on the surface. It's better than some of the alternatives, except that it is completely devoid of any mentality of chesed. And that's a crucial component for the capitalist society to work. On the other hand, a communist society can also be devoid of chesed. And as I think it's also pointed out in that article, that when the society deprives everyone of any possibility of private property, then no one can engage in chesed because no one has anything to give. No one has the ability to give tzedakah because that's all taken over by the state. So we're not thrilled with any of these options, and we have this pendulum swinging back and forth, and ultimately Avraham Avinu is going to introduce a culture of chesed into the world, the opposite of Sodom, and that's who's going to become our ancestors. So as a precursor to all of that, and this week's parasha, so we have the extremes of capitalism and extremes of communism, and the Aliyah that we're focused on here, Shvi, seems to essentially be describing a socialist setting. And the Aliyah begins, the first pasuk, V'hi chal ha'aretz safa echas u'dvaram achadim. So everybody was on the same page. Everybody spoke one language, and they had one style of speaking. If you look in some of the commentaries, like Rav Hirsch, and also there's Naim Latorah, so this idea of dvarim achadim is a uniformity in terms of not just the language, but also in terms of how they formed words and sentences. Everything was very uniform. Everything was not at all diverse. That's a point that we'll come to. And here in this post-Dor, this post-Mabul era, the post-Diluvian context, people are not yet spread out into different cultures, and they're all essentially coming from the same place. So that coming means they're going somewhere. So where exactly are they going? So the next pasuk goes on to say, "Vayihi b'nasam mikedem." So they journeyed from the east to the west. V'yimtzu vika be'eretz shinar v'yeshvu sham. So they're looking for somewhere to settle. You have they're gravitating away from where they were dropped off, where the whole all of humanity landed with the teva. So now they are heading westward, and they find a place to stop. So let's find a place to stop here for a second on this pasuk, and note that there is a lot to try to figure out about what the Torah is emphasizing. And this whole idea that they were journeying, and they're journeying in a certain direction. So what exactly are we supposed to learn from here? So here I'll just mention maybe for a few minutes, Rav Nevenzahl has an essay on the whole story here. Really covers the whole Aliyah, actually. It's a very interesting essay because it sees the integration of the topics in this Aliyah. So it's part of what we can benefit from that we laid out the themes before we started, because Rav Nevenzahl's essay sees these themes as connected, as essentially making a point. And as I'll mention afterwards, some of the commentaries see the exact opposite notions. But the way Rav Nevenzahl understands it is that this is all about Eretz Yisrael, that this is all about the realization, even then, even at that point in history, that there was an area that was holy, an area that was God-centered, and the hope is that humanity is going to head in that direction. That's what's supposed to happen. Everyone is supposed to go there and to recognize God's presence. And that was the idea. However, it gets sidetracked, and Nimrod is able to win over people to some of the attractive land in between, and that itself is a problem. And so Rav Nevenzahl notes, he thinks that's also why it says later on that when God judges them, in Pasuk Hey, just to look ahead for a second, it says, "Vayered Hashem liros es ha'ir v'es ha'migdol, asher bonu v'nei ha'adam." So God goes down to examine not just the tower, but also the city. So what's so terrible about the city? The problem is where it is. It's in the wrong place, that they stopped along the way. And that's a part of what we're seeing here in this whole story, is where there was a misstep. And in that context, so he has a number of questions. Again, this addresses the whole Aliyah as a whole. We'll just mention it here. Is that's what the pasuk here is coming to convey about their nesiyah, about their travel, that they're supposed to be heading towards Kedusha. But they stop along the way, and that's the theme of the entire Aliyah, that we end with Avram Avinu, because Avram Avinu is the part of the culture that keeps going. And suggests also that as we then transition into next week's parsha, we talk about Lech Lecha, Me'artzecha, Me'olaretecha, Beis Avicha, those three stages. It's meant to represent that at each point there are people who are making the journey, and part of that group isn't making it all the way. So Avram is being told, you keep going, you continue all the way to find the place of Kedusha. So first you have to leave your land, then you have to leave your birthplace, and you have to leave your family. Each point is another stage where we're saying, okay, the group that you're with is not making it all the way, is not taking the trip to its full conclusion, but Avram, that's your mission. And he's the one who realizes that that's what has to happen. So he also suggests that that's the pshat in the Mishnah that we mentioned about the 10 generations and about how they all angered God, and only Avram is the one who made it worthwhile, and Avram got the schar of all of them. So what does that mean, the schar of all of them? So if they were bad people, so then why is there any schar at all? And if the idea is that they had a little bit of schar even though they were largely bad, so why does the schar go to Avram and not go to them? So it says with Nevenzahl that the idea is that the point was they're supposed to be aware that there is a place in the world that calls attention to the Ribbono Shel Olam, and they're supposed to be headed there, and the generations in between, so many of them start, but they don't get all the way. And if they don't get all the way, so then they're not going to accomplish what needs to be accomplished. And it's only Avram who actually gets all the way, and therefore the mitzvah is called Achar Gomra, after the one who actually completes the mission, that's Avram. So that's what the Mishnah is getting at when it says he gets the schar of all the generations in between. So that's essentially how he understands that this is the theme of not just the story, but the whole Aliyah, everything that we're reading about here. All right.
Does that make Shiva like particularly significant then, because it's a very low land? It seems like the lowest area where all the bodies go, and it seems to be
okay. Okay, that's certainly symbolically the idea, but that certainly fits the point. And it could be the dimensions that I remember. But the whole point here also, this is not so much what he says, but I think you can see this here as well, that a part of the message of Eretz Yisrael, part of the message of having a physical home for the Shekhinah, is the recognition that the materiality of this world, everything that we have, we're meant to use it for a purpose. We're meant to elevate it and not just enjoy it. Enjoying is important, but enjoying it for its own sake as opposed to elevating it into something that is meaningful and something that helps fulfill our mission in this world, that's where we go astray. So the notion of heading towards the land of Israel is the land where you have a physical reality that represents God awareness. And the tower, the Migdal, ends up being the opposite, ends up being this big project that is about ignoring God or about challenging God. So essentially, it goes to miss the point that if we're going to build a big building, we do so because it's going to be in the service of God, it's going to be in the service of positive things, as opposed to being a idea in and of itself, and that's also a part of what is at the core of their whole mistake here, their whole transgression. It's also interesting to note that if you look in his Naim L'Torah, the Litzkirav, so he seems to have the opposite reading on this idea of the Nesia, of the traveling, in a sense, and he has a comment which reflects the fact, we'll discuss more about this, that a lot of what's going on with the construction of the tower and the like is this great fear of another flood and the hope that they can find some way to work around whatever a flood would represent. So the Naim L'Torah suggests, you know, why is that all of a sudden happening now? So he says that the idea is they wanted to travel far away because they wanted to be Porek Ol. They wanted to shirk the responsibility of being people who were aware of God and who felt they had any mission to live a meaningful life. They wanted to go to pursue their own interests. So therefore, the place where the Nes happened, the place where they were saved from the flood, they're looking to move away from that. They're looking to travel away from any such reminder so that they can essentially abandon the notion that they are creatures of God who have responsibility to this world. And if that's the case, so they recognize that maybe that means that the covenant is going to break also, that God's promise that he's not going to bring a flood upon the world again, maybe that's only once they are upholding their part of the bargain. So if they're going to move away, they feel that they're perhaps putting that at risk. And that's why, together with this whole story, everything is focused on trying to figure out how can they thwart, how can they avoid the next flood. So it's an interesting interpretation also, but you see it's essentially, at least in one regard, the opposite of what Rav Neventhal said, that this traveling was a traveling that was looking for greater Kedusha, and Rav Neventhal's idea just doesn't go far enough. So here this Naim L'Torah is saying the opposite, saying this travel is to travel away from God's awareness, and that's what manifests itself in what they end up doing. Okay, so here the next pasuk takes the story a little further. So they start making materials. Vayomru ish al reyehu, which perhaps this context will translate as comrade. And so each one said to his comrade, Hava nilbin alavanim, let's get together and make bricks. V'nisra filisreifa v'tehilahem halavena v'oven v'hachemer hayalahem v'chomer. So if you look at Rav Hirsch here, he has extensive commenting about how this is all about transitioning from simply taking the natural materials that are there and using them, but actually making them into man-made materials and using the fire and using the creation of brick towards the next step. So this is a part of man attempting to conquer his environment and to do something with it. The question is, what's he going to do with it? So this focus on the bricks is interesting, and there is a comment in the Pirkei Der Belazer, which is a widely quoted comment, and is also consistent with what we mentioned before, the idea that they have a socialistic environment here which devalues the individual. So the Pirkei Der Belazer has a comment that they put a lot of effort into these bricks, and if a brick would fall and break, they'd be very upset that they invested all this time and effort to make these bricks, and now they're broken. But if one of them would fall and die, so then, okay, what can you do? So you move on to the next guy. And the notion of any individual significance and worth, it seems, was highly devalued, and everything was focused, all the attention was paid to this joint project. So that idea, this very evocative comment about bricks being more important than people, is consistent with a lot of different ideas that we have here. It's consistent, again, with the most negative image of communism. It's consistent with the idea that they saw their project as an end in and of itself rather than a means to an end. If you believe you're building a yeshiva, you're building a shul, so then presumably you'll have a pretty acute understanding that the bricks are secondary and that the people who it serves is really what it's about. But if you see the building as the goal in itself, so much so that people don't matter and the bricks do, so that perhaps flows from such a perspective. My good friend Rabbi Dr. Yitzi Schechter has a very important article about this, which I can't do full justice to because it draws on his particular expertise in the realm of psychology and Torah in great detail, but you should definitely take a look. It was published in the first volume of Mitoch Ohel on the Parshas HaShavua. So in Parshas Noach, he has an essay focusing on Migdal Bavel and on what it reflects about the psychological reality. And that among the many points that he makes there in great detail is the idea that here these people are feeling vulnerable. Right? So in the past there's been a terrible flood and humanity did not survive, and for the most part, and they feel...
Who wrote this?
Dr. Yitzchak Schechter, Dr. Isaac Schechter. And it's in the Mitoch Ohel, Volume 1, Parshas Noach. So there, he points out that this sense of vulnerability becomes a form of narcissism, that they become focused only on how will they protect themselves, how will they set up a fort, a bulwark against whatever may come, to the point where they are unable to relate to the other as independent people of any importance. And again, invoking this medrash, invoking this idea that they were more concerned about the bricks, about the materials, than about the people. And that this is a common reaction, that when one becomes very vulnerable and in denial of that vulnerability, then one also becomes unable to connect with others, which is the opposite of what we are looking for a religious reaction, that instead it should cause one to turn to God. And ultimately, again, here Avram's attitude and Avram's life mission becomes the opposite of some of these prevailing attitudes. If that's really the perspective here, it's also perhaps a very appropriate message for us in this room who have the dual connection both of having observed Sukkot last week and are learning Sukkot all year. So the theme of Sukkot, we had a little bit of an opportunity to discuss. We talked about Diras Arai and Diras Kava. But the whole idea to recognize that, yes, we are vulnerable, that our fancy buildings are not going to save us necessarily. But ultimately, it's not about denying the importance of the other, but rather it's about turning to God. And unfortunately, here in the United States, we've had so many reminders, really so many horrible reminders in so many different regions of the United States, our very rich, developed country, of just how much having a strong building is not a protection, ultimately. And other horrible things have happened in the past few weeks in California, and before that in Florida and Texas and Puerto Rico. What we've seen just on our own Dalai Lama, so to speak, of how being in a strong building is not necessarily going to save you, but ultimately the Ribbono Shel Olam is in control of everything. So that's clearly a dominant theme within Sukkos. And we suggested that even Rabbi Yehuda's Diras Aroi perhaps reflects such an idea. I'm sorry, Rabbi Yehuda's Diras Keva, that Sukkah should be even a Diras Keva, and that you bring the Aroi awareness into the Keva. So here, that's a good segue into this parsha, into the story, because that also seems to be reflective here. And again, especially the current events, so much of it has been about water and about floods. So we really, this year, unfortunately, have a real appreciation for just what a flood can mean, what the power of water is. So here, this theme that takes us from Sukkot to Parshas Noach to what's going on around us is very powerfully appreciated. So the next pasuk tells us, pasuk Dalet, they have this declaration: "Vayomru hava nivnalanu ir." Umigdal v'roshu v'shamayim v'nasa lanu shem pen nafut salpanei kol haaretz. So they say, okay, let's build this tower, and the head of the tower is going to be up in Shamayim, and we'll make a name for ourselves, because we have to be concerned, pen, otherwise we should get scattered throughout the whole land. So here, it's not 100% clear what exactly it is that they're trying to do that was so objectionable. It sounds pretty bad, but we have to figure out what exactly is the issue. So there are different interpretations. Here there's an interesting comment before we say further, that in the Psalm Derech, in the Sefer of Reb Simcha Zissel Broid, Rashiv the Chevron Yeshiva, so he notes critically that what they wanted to do was to impede the process of diversification, that humanity is about to diversify, is on the verge, on the cusp of becoming many different nations of many different cultures, and they essentially want to stop that process. They want to say, ah, no further, let's all plant ourselves here, and let's all maintain the one language and the one style and the one perspective. And there's a lot to object about that. Nowadays, so it's always commented that nowadays we have a enhanced appreciation for diversity, but sometimes it's a little bit of a deflection, because the diversity isn't always complete, that we want also diversity of attitudes and perspectives, and very often that we don't have in contemporary discourse, that we have a intimidation and a uniformity that's imposed on our discourse. So one way or another, we're looking for diversity, and a genuine diversity. And they, the door of this tower, they stopped that process. They tried to stop that process. They said, here, let's stay here and not go any further, and not branch out, and not change, and not have any variances. He also points out, it's hard to see this as the whole point of it, but he also points out that the Jews have benefited from diverse nations in terms of our safety. That the Gemara says that it's a chesed that the Kadosh Baruch Hu scattered us among different nations, on the one hand because we're not all in one place to be attacked at once, but also because the nations are not all on the same page. So at one point, one culture will be against us, and other cultures will be more positively disposed, and then it will switch. But because the world is diverse, we don't have the whole unified wrath of the world against us at any one time. Which also reflects the fact that, similar to what we said before about capitalism and communism, it's not like there's any one culture or there's any one ideology out there that is totally compatible with the mission of the Torah. It's all a mix of different positives and negatives. And that's a part of what we contend with, and that's the way the world is meant to be set up, that there's going to be different cultures and different languages and different perspectives, and sometimes they will challenge us and fight us, but the fact that it's a diverse world helps to mitigate that effect, and that's a part of God's vision for how this was going to play out, and this is a part of what they were challenging. So the Gemara Maseches Sanhedrin and Daf Kuftes, so the Gemara has a couple of different opinions as to what exactly their Avera was. And the truth is, the opinions are really more about just figuring out what is the idea of going up into the sky, what's the idea of building a tower. So the Gemara there says that Rav Shela, for example, said this was meant to be a basis a base from which to attack God. They thought they could make war on God up there, and that they would take shovels and they would poke on the water storage containment system, whatever they thought was up there as far as where the flood comes from. And they said, okay, we will thwart the next flood that will go up there, and we'll poke holes in all of the water containers, and it'll all spill out, and that will save us, and no problems will ever happen again. That would seem to cause a flood. So they, I don't know how well they thought this through, but I guess they have this idea that if they get it from the sides, it won't have the same effect. Didn't seem to be a perfect plan. But the next opinion the Gemara has is Rav Yirmiyahu ben Elazar, who says that they wanted to live up there. They wanted to create a high place to live. And then it breaks down into different goals of what that was meant to accomplish. Is that going to be a way to make war on the world from up there? Is that for other reasons? But that was the emphasis of the high tower. And the third opinion is Rav Nosson, is that they did this L'shem Avodah Zarah, that that was the idea of this high structure. There is a fascinating comment in the Sefer Tiferes Yehonasan, Rav Yonasan Eibshitz, who lived in the 1700s, so he was very prescient, very prescient. He said that he thinks that what was going on here is, what did the generation of the tower, what was their career aspiration? Just like every 7-year-old boy, what did they want to do? They wanted to be astronauts, right? They thought that if they keep going high enough, they hadn't yet developed rocket fuel, or it was a couple of centuries, a couple of millennia yet to come, so they had a couple steps missing, but they thought that, okay, if they get high enough with their tower, then they could become astronauts. They'll get to the point where they will, this is what he talks about, that they will be able to defy gravity, because if you go beyond the atmosphere, you'll get up to the point where you're outside of the Earth's orbit, and then they'll never have to come back down. That's what he describes, that they could get high enough where they'll be able to float and nothing will fall down, and that they could inhabit the space regions. So it's a very fascinating perspective against that. And then the Tiferes Yehonasan over here on this pasuk, that's how he describes what's happening. Hi.
What's the basis for?
That's how he understands, like, what's this idea of going up high, and the notion that that's somehow going to help them, and that they'll be saved from the flood. So that's what he thought, that they, once they hit it, they figured that once they hit a certain point, they'll be able to just have everything float with them, nothing's going to fall back down again, and they can just orbit and take many big steps for mankind. And it's a fascinating discussion. But again, if you take a look, it's in the Tiferes Yonasan over here. We should make a name for ourselves. Right, so right, that's what's explicit. That's what's explicit. So the question is, that's why I mentioned also that the different opinions in the Gemara, they kind of subdivide, because they don't, not really about what was the Avera, a little bit mentioning Avodah Zarah, but it's not really about what was the Avera, it's more about what was the plan. And then the plan could be understood in a number of different ways. So in a sense, the pasuk, by talking about let's make a name for ourselves, is giving us a clue into the nature of the Avera, and the opinions of the Gemara are more about what's the point of the altitude. You know, is the point to have a base to attack God? Is it they want to live up there? Is it the Avodah Zarah? That seems to be more, it's addressing a different component of what's going on. Okay, so it's also very interesting, the next two psukim. So first of all, here also this is the imagery of God coming down. V'yeirid Hashem liros es ha'ir v'yasa migdal asher banu b'nei adam. So we read this pasuk before. We mentioned that it was Rav David Sal's point of why he was judging the ear also. Some of the others far, and I think Rav Hirschman has a comment about this, about why the ear is mentioned if the ear doesn't seem to be the problem. So if I recall correctly, what Rav Hirsch says, that the idea is that building buildings is not necessarily by itself an aveir, which goes a little bit to your question, right? That what they were doing is they were building a building. Okay, so what does that mean? What's exactly the intent behind that? So whatever their aveir was, it clearly was very much impacted by their attitude and their goals of what they were doing. With their action is not something that was inherently sinful or inherently wrong. It's more about what their intent was. So therefore, the idea of seeing the city is because that's where the culture is. So it's not that if you want to judge them, kriyacha, whatever it means, the Kadosh Baruch Hu coming down to judge them, so what has to be factored in? Not just the tower itself, because the tower maybe is a good thing, or the tower maybe is a neutral thing. but the ideology behind it is a part of the problem, or maybe is the whole problem. So therefore, we have to see what's being said in the ear, what's being said in the city, to know how that defines the nature of the problem. Again, I mentioned Devinsel's point earlier, a different understanding that it's because of where the ear was, because it stopped along the way instead of making it there as well. That's why it's included here. Okay, so what's the declaration? This is Vayomer Hashem. So God says, Hein Am Echad, V'Safa Achas L'Chulam. You have this one nation, and they all have one language. Hachilam La'Asos. So look what they've begun to do. V'Ata Lo Yibotzer Mehem Kol Asher Yozmu La'Asos. So what does that phrase mean? Lo Yibotzer Mehem Kol Asher Yozmu La'Asos. Anyone know how to translate that? What does that mean? So the word sounds like it means that whatever they plan to do, like Hashir Zomim, like Ba'idim Zomim, whatever their plot is, it's not going to be restrained from them. It's not going to be held back from them. So, but is that really the case? So it is going to be, right? It's going to be held back. They're going to be stopped. God's going to thwart them. So Rashi here comments, if you look at Rashi, Rashi says it's Bismia. That it's this expression of the opposite. It's an ironic or astonishment phrase. Saying, what? You think I'm going to let this happen? God's saying, you think I'm going to let them just go and not restrain them? No, but I am going to restrain them. I'm going to stop them. That's how Rashi understands. He explains also, Yibotzer Loshen Minia, means to hold back. So God is saying, of course I'm going to stop them. So the language is Bitmia. What? I'm not going to stop them? Of course I'm going to stop them. But if you look in the Sforno, and in the Zohar also, which seems to be the basis, that he understands that, no, it's literal. That it means that if I don't do something, then indeed they will be successful, they will be unrestrained, and that the statement seems to be part of the power of Achdus, that God is saying, listen, right now they are united, they have this common purpose and this common goal, and if we don't shake them up, then they're going to succeed, they're going to, well, presumably they can't succeed fully, but they're going to accomplish much more than one might think than they actually could do. So it's a statement about the power of Achdus, and that we should be aware of just what exactly it could accomplish. So the Baruch Simon Shlita has an essay about this in his Sefer Imrei Baruch, and he talks about this point, and of course there also from the Ashvei Rav, from the Ber Moshe, that it's a little bit surprising. We're going to advertise Achdus through these bad guys. We're going to advertise Shalom through this evil plot. Doesn't seem to be the greatest commercial for Shalom. So he said, essentially, that's a little bit the point, that you see that even here, when it's for a negative purpose, you see that Shalom has such a powerful impact. Imagine when it's from a positive purpose. You could perhaps relate this. I mentioned once, the drush once, Parshas Shlach, that there's a similar idea that the mocker for minyan, right? The idea that there is a significance to 10 men getting together as a congregation is derived from the Meraglim, at least according to one opinion in the Gemara. It's derived from Gzeir Shava, but the Eda, what's an Eda? An Eda is the Meraglim, and the bad Meraglim, it's not just the Meraglim who are mostly bad, but specifically the bad Meraglim, the 10 and the 12, the bad ones specifically, that is the definition of an Eda. That's how we get a minion. So I guess this is what comforts people when they can't make a minion and say, well, it's all a group of Meraglim anyway. But the idea that this is where we look for the Meraglim, for a minion, is pretty fascinating point. We'd have to look to a bad group. So one could say, well, maybe that's the point, that if it works for bad things, all the more so it should work for good things. We have a statement that Gemara says sometimes that Gedola Mitatova, Meruba Mitatova Mitzperanius, that the power of good is always more than the power of bad. So if 10 men getting together for something negative is going to give them strength, so imagine what would happen if that strength was harnessed for good. Now the truth is, it's interesting to reflect that it's not an obvious point that to say, well, if it's effective for bad, it's all more effective for good. And Nebuch, we've seen also in recent events, if you look at terrorism, for example, that Rahman al-Tzlan, one person can do a lot of damage. And it's not really the same that if you try to invert it to say one person can do so much good, it's not as easy for one person to do as much good as portion amount of damage. One person can destroy what 100 people put together. really is a tremendous power here for negativity. But perhaps the point is that nonetheless, when you have people getting together for a common purpose, the very fact that they have to factor in what everyone else needs, so that already changes it, that already makes it more positive, and that already makes it more effective. And perhaps that's one of the messages here. If you look back again in the Imre Baruch and Rabbi Simon Sefer, so he also quotes the Medrash that this language of Yata, right, this notion of God saying they're not going to be restrained, Vata, and now, so the Medrash has a comment that Vata is a pischon peh for is a pischon for tshuva, is an opening for tshuva. God was saying that, oh, they could do tshuva, and then they're not going to be held back in their plans. So that's just an interesting idea, and he quotes there Rabbi Simon from the Beis Yisrael of Ger, that the idea of Atah representing Shuva is because it's the focus on the importance of now, on the recognition that now has its own significance that's different from everything in the past. So that's the mindset, that's the attitude of Shuva, and that's a very powerful statement. Okay, so basically God thwarts their plan, as we see. And Vayofetz Hashem Osa Misham Al Panei Chol Haaretz V'yachtelu Levnoso Yer. So he scatters them around, and they stop to do what they're doing. And you would have thought perhaps that even if they couldn't understand each other, so then still they could continue living there. But we see, and this is something also Dr. Schechter discusses in his article, that the communication issue isn't just about the practicalities. It isn't just about, okay, it's difficult for people to carry out their plans. They can't live together anymore. They have completely incompatible goals and messages for each other. And this is something very very evocatively, somewhat graphically described in the Drashim also, that in terms of how people would get a very different result, and they say they ask for a brick and they end up getting injured quite badly. So here you see that it's not just about not speaking the same language, it's about being fundamentally misaligned and miscommunicating. And that's essentially a big part of what happens here. So then the story essentially ends. Al kein kara shema bavel kisham balo Hashem sfas kol haaretz u'misham hafitzam Hashem al pnei kol haaretz. So therefore it's called Bavel because God mixed up all of their languages, and from there they scatter into different cultures. And again, it's interesting how things can be good or bad, because here this is clearly presented as the thwarting of their plans, yet we devote our lives here to studying Talmud Bavli. And the Rishonim discussed, the Gemara suggests in one place, that Bavli represents a blila, a mixture of all the different cultures and influences, and that we're able to draw from that in a positive sense, perhaps, and to elevate that. It's also a fascinating contrast. Okay, so these first 9 psukim make up the story of the tower, and then you have many psukim going on for a long time, talking about all the generations, and making it clear before we leave the parsha that we ultimately reach Avram Avinu. So just to say a few words about that, of course his name is not yet Avram, his name is Avram. But the Torah tells us that he has come on the scene. Again, the Mishnah making the comment that God tolerated society until then. And we're told in Pasuch of Zayin, Ve'ela told us, Terach holid es Avram, es Nachor v'es Haran, v'Haran holid es Lot. So we have a story here of Avram. Avram is the son of Terach, and he has these two brothers, Nachor and Haran. Haran has Lot. Little foreshadowing for the stories we're going to read about him. And the pasuk tells us, "V'yamas Haran al pnei Terach Aviv beretz molatato b'orkazdim." So this brother Haran, he dies. He dies al pnei Terach Aviv. Rashi tells us it means that he died during the lifetime of Terach, that he died relatively young. And the Rashi fills in the whole story over there, that Terach made that. Here you have the whole story with Avram and Nimrod, and Nimrod ends up throwing Avram into the furnace. So here Rashi quotes, "V'Haran Yoshev Omer Belibo." So Haran is sitting and watching this whole thing, and he says, "Okay, here's the story. very brotherly love here. Im Avram Leitzeach, Ani Mishalom. Avram wins, and I'm on his team. And Im Nimrod Leitzeach, Ani Mishalom. Nimrod's going to win, and I'm on his team. Kishenitzel Avram, and Avram ends up being saved, Amr Lelaharan, Mishal Miata. So then people said to Haran, so whose team are you on? What did you decide? So Avram Haran, Mishal Avramani. I'm with brother. I'm with Avram. He's the winner here. Hishlichu l'chivshon ha'es v'nisraf. So they threw him into the fire furnace and he was burnt. Zahu or Kazdim. So that's what we're talking about when we refer to or Kazdim. So this whole backstory, there's a lot to talk about. And the Sefer Ol Moshe quotes from Shalom Shwadron who tries to figure the story out because it's hard to understand. It sounds like Haran essentially pays the price for picking the right side, for picking the side of Avram Avinu. That's a little hard to understand. It's also noteworthy that everyone else didn't. This is also something Bali Musser comment on, that you'd think that after seeing this miraculous saving of Avram, that everyone would be on Avram's side. And yet apparently no, they don't want to change, they want to stick with it, and they want to stem the tide of any movement that's going to follow Avram, so they end up killing Haran. And that's itself very, very striking about just how people think. But why does Haran not merit a miracle of his own? So there's a whole discussion there that really Haran is not such a hero. I mean, in the other context, you say, okay, that people who are impressed by a great Kiddush Hashem, so then they deserve to get that credit and to move on like that. But Haran, essentially, as he puts it, was creating a third side here. That there was the Avram side and Nimrod side, and then there's a kind of opportunistic, well, we'll wait and see who wins side, which doesn't really come from any place of actual meaning. And to suggest that that's also the language here, that he's basically just kind of claiming he's signing up for the side, he's not actually subscribing to all the ideals and values, and therefore there isn't any great merit to protect. Okay, so the pasuk goes on to say, "Vayikach Avram v'Nachor lohem nashim shem eishes Avram saroi v'shem eishes Nachor milka bas Haran avi milka avi yiska." So there is a question that the Sam Derech with Simchas Zuchel Broid asks. He doesn't give an answer. He just brings it to your attention, and he says, "Ein ze omer el darsheni." This is clearly something that's meaningful. It's clearly something that requires a drasha. So I'll give this to you so you can think about it over Shabbos. You can think if you have an idea what the Torah is getting at here. He's just pointing it out and asking the readers to try to figure out what the message is. But there's something interesting going on here in terms of Sarah, that it seems like the Torah is essentially not showing any relationship to Sarah. That when Sarah, we know what her family background is, but it's always mentioned indirectly. So here in this pasuk, so okay, we know that Sarah is Shaykh to Avram, she's Avram's wife, but the rest you have to figure out indirectly. So here, Shemeshos Nochar Milka Bas Haran, who is Haran? Haran is the father of Milka and the father of Yiska. Who's Yiska? Says Rashi, Yiska is Sarah. So okay, Sarah, the same one from the first half of the pasuk, so why don't you just say that was Sarah's father. So there seems to be some goal here in the Torah to specifically not directly associate Sarah with her family. You can figure out based on tracing the words, but that the more simple way of saying it, and then to Pesukim again also, where you find out about Lot's whole lineage there. So okay, it just says Haran Holy does Lot. But understand where Sarah comes from, so you have to do all the math, and that Bas Haran is the father of Yiska, and Yiska happens to also be Sarah, so it seems like there is a reason why the Torah is conveying it this way, and he just leaves it off on the note of Darsheni. So maybe you have a drasha?
Was Haran the Ovia or Zara?
So that's what we just had, what happened here, that he just picked the side of Avram. So he probably started off as an Ovia or Zara, like the whole family, and he picked the side of Avram after Avram wins, but it seems like that wasn't enough to save him, that didn't give him a lasting merit, and that's what he was commenting why that is.
Does the Torah maybe not want us to get the impression that Sarah is similar to follow her family?
It seems to be that there's some kind of message here of the break, although it seems like we would have gotten that anyway, and it's true about Avram, you know, also, and it's true about others, so I wonder if that's the whole story. It could be. And then we're told also about Hi Sarai Akara in Lo Vlad, which is a double statement. And here Chazal have a comment also that it was a real miracle that she ever had children, because she was barren in the contextual setting. But also she was inherently, Gemara says she was an islandist, she was really physically incapable from birth of having children. And so the fact that she ends up having children is a tremendous miracle. So then the psukim go on to say, Vayikach terach es Avram b'no, v'yas lot ben Haran b'no, v'yas sarai koloso, esh es Avram b'no, v'yetsu itam v'yorkaz d'malach es arz z'kanan, v'yavo archaran v'yesh v'sham. So okay, so Terach takes the whole family with him, and they leave from Orkazdim, and they go towards Canaan, and that's their travel. So the last pasuk ends, the Eliyah ends, Vayhi Yimei Sarah Chamei Shonim Umasayim Shana Vayamas Terach B'Charan. So here we have the whole life span of Terach, and Terach dies. So here there is a interesting idea, and we'll end on this note. The Psalm Derech, again, Breit has a discussion about this as well, that there is a fascinating comment that you find in Rashi. And it's not clear what to do with it, as he points out. That it says that Terach died in Haran, but he didn't die yet. If you do the math, he has many more years to live. So why is he dying now, specifically the last words of Parshas Noach before Lech Lecha? So Rashi addresses it. Rashi writes, just to read the middle of the Rashi, why is the Torah telling us about the death of Terach before Avram's journey in the next parasha, the beginning of Lech Lecha? Shlo yehei hadavar mefursim lachal. So it shouldn't be so public to everyone. V'yomru lo kiyem Avram is kved aviv, shinichu zakein v'halacha. That it would be a bad thing if the Shmua were to spread that here Avram just neglected his elderly father and went off to make Aliyah, went off to live in Israel. So therefore the Torah describes his death beforehand. It's a very pleadic Rashi, right? As the Sfarim Derech points out, like, what are you supposed to do with that? That's just telling us how the words are phrased in the Torah. So if the concern was that people are going to gossip about Avram, that he's abandoning his elderly father and going to Israel, so how does it help that the Torah talks about it before? So they'll all just do Shnai Mikra and they'll forget that he's still around. What exactly is the message here? So he has a comment that you see that the very precise nature of the Torah reflects reality, and that what it's basically saying is that the placement here in the Chumash is a way of telling us that indeed he basically fell off the map, that even though he was still alive, but people were not aware of him and people were not paying attention to him, and therefore nobody was saying that, oh, this terrible Avram, he neglected the elderly father at home, and it just wasn't something that was on anyone's mind. So the Torah, by telling us that he died at this point, even though he actually physically dies later, by mentioning his death here, it's a way of saying that at this point in the story, he was essentially not on anyone's mind. He wasn't being the topic of discussion. So I think this is just an important comment at a good time to emphasize how what this says about the nature of the concept of Kiddush Hashem and Chil Hashem. Because this could seem like a disturbing idea. What exactly is happening here? So Avram did leave him and went on to live in Eretz Yisrael, went on to Eretz Yisrael. So are we saying that there's a cover-up here? That basically the Torah phrases it a certain way to make it sound as if he didn't neglect his parents? And, okay, with this, that was just God's orchestrating the story so that nobody was paying attention to this either. So it's basically a cover-up. Essentially, we want to distort the truth. So I don't think that's the case. I think that this is similar to what we sometimes talk about when we refer to Kiddush Hashem. And you could ask the same questions there. I think it's important to emphasize what we're really talking about. That when we talk about a Kiddush Hashem and we say emphasize a certain behavior because of the impression that it creates, it doesn't mean that we're saying all we care about is image and all we care about is what people say about us, and therefore we're even willing to misrepresent the halacha, misrepresent what we're doing, so that people will say good things. God forbid. What it means is that there are certain values, and it's very important that these values are always understood, and that no one get the wrong impression about the Torah and about the halacha, that these values are not there. So when there is a concern that somebody may misunderstand the situation that's in front of him and may think that there is a value that Judaism does not properly value, is not properly esteemed, so then the halacha of Kiddush Hashem tells us, make sure to emphasize that value, make sure this genuine Torah value that's really there but could get obscured, make sure that that's something that people will see and understand is a crucial part of Torah Judaism. So here, when it comes to Avram's decision, those of you who were with us at the end of last year, in June, when we were learning the sugyas of Kibud Av V'Aim, so you might recall that we spoke about this whole dynamic, that there is a whole discussion in general, halacha l'maisa, about whether one should make aliyah if that means they're going to neglect taking care of the parents of Kibud Av V'Aim versus Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. And there are those who say that really Kibud Av V'Aim comes first, because there is a medrash, there's a statement in Chazal that on next week's parasha, Alech Lecha, that emphasizes the personal nature of the instruction to Avram, and that says that you, for you, it makes sense, you have to go to the land of Israel now, but you I will exempt from Kibud Av V'Aim, but that's an exception, that's not the normal situation. So if that's what's going on, it means that Kibud Av V'Aim really is a very important consideration. Just happens to be for the needs of this circumstance, Avram was told he has to focus on something else. So somebody could look at this and say, oh yeah, these Jews and these ancestors of Jews, they don't care about Kibud Av V'Aim. So it's not true. It's only that there was a specific azhara, a specific instruction to Avram Avinu that required him to prioritize going to the land of Israel. But as a value, Kibud Av V'Aim as a default value certainly is very important. So therefore, we don't want people getting the wrong idea and focusing on Terach being left behind and thinking, oh, the Jews don't care about Kibud Av V'Aim, because not that that's something we're just afraid of being criticized about, it's because that's not really the value. So since that's not really the general policy, so we don't want anyone getting the wrong idea. So similar to the way we talk about Kiddush Hashem, so to here we find that there was a decreased focus on Terach's continued being alive, so that one shouldn't get the misimpression about the role of Kibud Av V'Aim. Hi.
Why would this be considered a chalasha? It's natural for a child to lose.
So it's a question of whether that really is appropriate. So this is a big discussion last year. Forgive you for not being here last year in June, but next time make sure to be here in last June. But so we talked there about the question. It's not so pasha, the question of when there's a Kibud Av V'Aim mandate, so is it really free reign for the child to leave the area and to not worry about that? So this was a significant back and forth among poskim, but not everyone was so sure that that really is the case. The question of Eretz Yisrael is an added component, maybe just even without that, but let's say especially, or even if there is a mitzvah involved of making aliyah, does that still mean that one is allowed to do that and to neglect the Kibud Av V'Aim? So many are not so sure. At some point, the Medrash about Avram, you know, that Avram is an exception, but otherwise one has to be more worried about this. So that's perhaps what we mean by the wrong idea, that really, as far as the values Lidoros, that one does have to worry more about not neglecting the parents. But for whatever reason, Avram was an exception. He had a mission here that required him to do that. But because that could give you the wrong idea of what is the halach l'daris, of what is the continuing balance here, then that's why it was necessary that people not pay attention to this, not see what's going on. Again, not because we want to misrepresent the value, because we want to represent the value. We don't want people to get the wrong idea. So to keep them from getting the wrong idea, from not looking at this exception and thinking that it's reflective of the whole system, perhaps that's what took place. Okay, so I guess this is a good place to stop. Who wants to daven for us? Ladies, you're standing up.
Sure.